Hello and welcome to the Tyler Sen podcast episode number 94. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of thetylersen.com, and we have come to the last stop of our 2015-16 tour, and it takes us to the Hope Tap pub in Reading. Much like our Christmas special, there's going to be a bit of background noise this one, so apologies in advance. We are cautiously optimistic though that there will be no Premier League game going on while we record this show, although that seemed to be a fairly historic moment on the way to Leicester's title run. Some would say it was a pivotal moment, chaps, when we recorded way back the Spread Eagle in December on the way to the title and beating Chelsea. Was that Jose's last game?
Jose's last game.
Yeah, very historic.
Yeah, indeed. So we're here again. We're in a pub setting to drown our sorrows after what has been a pretty miserable season. Let's be honest, Reading finishing 17th in the Championship. We're going to run down the highs, that won't take us very long, and the lows from the last campaign and try and figure out where it all went wrong and what we need to do to get it right next season. Joining me today, no Johnny Williams, no Alan West, no Steve Curtis even, but what we have got is a crack squad consisting of one Dave Handbags Harris. Dave, hello.
Good evening.
And one Mark May. Mark, hello.
Hello, thank you.
So, gents, it falls to the three of us. Nobody else was up to the challenge of trying to dissect this season, but we're going to give it our very best over the next hour or so.
Ambivalent reigns, doesn't it?
It does. I put the call out for questions quite a few times over the past few days, and not a lot of people have got around to giving us their views. I think apathy has set in, Mark.
Also, everyone has joined the Reading players on holiday. The Reading players having had a good month and a half start on them, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't think many of us can afford to join the Reading players on the sorts of holidays they'll be going on. But live and hope. Maybe those that sit in the Upper West are jetting off to the same sort of destinations.
I know, their season tickets are going up next year. They've got a cost cut.
In saying that, I did finish the season by going to Disney World because I hadn't seen enough Mickey Mouse this season. Thought just to get my quota up and get stocked in for next season. On that very bad joke, it's only right that we delve in to the recap, where we'll very quickly look back on the last couple of games since we recorded, that being the defeats to Preston and Blackburn.
View from the Tarhurst end. Recapping this week's Championship action.
So if you were hoping for a high note to end the campaign on, you were left bitterly disappointed as Reading's final home game ended in a 2-1 home reversal against Preston before a final day 3-1 defeat at Ewood Park to Blackburn left Reading 17th in the table on 52 points. That is 2 points and 2 places better off than last season, but still ranks as the second worst campaign we've had in the second tier that hasn't ended in relegation. So on that happy note, chaps, we'll cast your minds all the way back to that Preston game and that memorable lap of honour at the end of the game. 2-1 defeat for Reading, fully deserved?
Yes. Absolutely, we were, particularly in the first half, we were absolutely battered. The Preston will be somewhat disappointed that they weren't a 3 or 4 up at least at half time. The second half was a bit better, changed the shape slightly, brought on who was the new chap?
Barrett. Oh, it's Josh Barrett.
Josh Barrett. He actually looked to be have a fair bit of ability about him. It certainly seemed a bit tighter, but at the same time, the goals we gave away were just utterly laughable.
Yeah, the first one, Mark, who do you put that down to? It was a bit of a sort of a mix-up between Cooper, McShane and Al Habsi. Anyone in particular to blame, or was just a collective failure?
For the goal in itself, you could probably put it down to McShane more than anyone, but I thought Cooper made a number of mistakes in the first half at least, which could have ended up in conceding goals. The first half one Cooper missed, which led to Beckford being completely through on goal, having the whole half of the pitch to score in, wasn't quite enough to open the scoring, but then McShane let him in to have the whole box to score in. So in the end, yeah, I mean, it's irrelevant as to who let in the actual goal because the goal had been coming for so long, as Steve says.
Yeah, and Reading then almost bailed themselves out. It was a point they would not have deserved in any shape or form. Stephen Quinn with a great strike. And at that moment, Reading are on top. Suddenly you think, got 5 minutes to go here, we can grab this winner. And sums up the season, really. Preston go and nick a winner in the last minute. Again, fully deserved, but just a shambles, Dave.
Yeah, McShane didn't exactly cover himself in glory with either goal, did he? I mean, just going back to the first one, I think you can lay the blame at both their doors. I'd rather they both went for the ball and smacked into each other than both leaving it to each other. But yeah, the second goal was quite calamitous as well. The header out, attempted clearance from McShane, which went straight to their player and left a horrible gaping hole in the defence, which was, to be fair, beautifully exploited by Daniel Johnson. But yeah, you know, it just kind of summed up the season really. It was pretty pathetic goals to concede.
Yeah, other than Josh Barrett's little cameo, which I was very impressed with, the other man of the match for me was the shark slash dolphin that was bouncing around Y25, Y26, and the bloke that managed to catch the ball and do a runner with it. I think they were about the only two entertaining incidents from a running point of view.
And covered himself in glory while stuck in it as he was running up the stairs.
Yes, went all over the world, that video.
It did.
Also, shout out to the blown up condom that went all the way from Y26 all the way down to Y19 where I was sat.
Excellent
that longevity. That was an absolute epic journey that mimics that of the club itself.
Sounds as though I missed out on a load of fun and games then, doesn't it? Being sat up in the Upper West Gods for that single game.
All right,
my £5 premium.
Ooh, there you go. Well, to be fair, I was in hospitality once again. Third time this season I've been in there, and first time I've ever tasted defeat. So
sat next to Dylan Kerr.
I was.
Keith McPherson.
Dylan Kerr, Keith McPherson, and Simon Osborne were in the row in front of me.
I didn't spot Ozzy.
Yeah, he was there. He was at the other end.
Oh, that's why I didn't spot him. I spotted Dylan and Macca.
Yep, AD Williams made a little cameo as well.
Quite and everything.
Yeah, AD Williams made a little cameo appearance as well. So, yeah, good reunion from the class of 94, well, 93 to 95. They gave a little talk as well in the hospitality, so that was very nice. But, yeah, awful. The only question I've got here is very, very few fans stayed behind for the Lap of Honour. It was fittingly raining. Literally raining on Reading's parade at the end of the season. Was that right? I mean, should fans have maybe made more of an effort to give them the players a send-off, or did they get what they deserved, which was a very sparse, very light round of applause from what is probably was what about 3,000 people left in the ground?
Reading fans notoriously leave early for home games. I've always noticed this, and I've never really noticed it at other grounds unless Reading have just scored a late winner. That is also the fact that is Preston scored a late winner. A lot of people just shrugged their shoulders and left. I'm claiming the record of being the last person in the ground for last season because we've stayed behind to do the Tarlest End video with the hope that we'd have the players walking behind us and everything. It took 2 minutes to find everyone and it was done. So it really was a bit of a... I mean, you've got to do it in a sense. It feels like you've got to do it. And, yeah, they dragged themselves out and rushed back in.
What do you reckon, Dave? Should fans have stayed?
I don't think there's any question that the players didn't show any desire or effort. And for that, I think perhaps you could argue the case that plenty more fans and supporters should have stayed. But at the same time, it's been such a disappointing season from top to bottom at Reading Football Club, and people are disillusioned with the club. And when people are disillusioned, they don't tend to bestow their feelings. You know, there's just like sort of, you know, shrug, as Mark said, sort of shrug their shoulders. You know, we've lost again. Off we go then. You know, maybe next season, kind of thing. And it's like. This is like me. I mean, I left before the final whistle, which I rarely do. I say never. I have done it a couple of times in the past, but you know, that was basically as soon as the Preston winner went in, it was like, I can't be bothered with this anymore.
Yeah, don't blame you. I personally don't blame anyone that left early. I think almost think lapse of appreciation should be left for occasions when they're deserved. I mean, it's become quite a modern phenomenon, really. I don't really remember, sort of in the late 90s and early 2000s, players doing these laps of honours at the end of the season. I think it was if they had merit to, the players would come back out on the pitch and soak up the round of applause if they'd had a near miss or a good season, or maybe even when they got relegated, you know, to sort of G them up. But yeah.
You sort of think that with that sort of occasion, instead of going... they didn't really go into the tunnel, but instead of going to the thing and then having a big walk around, just staying out on the pitch for another couple of minutes or something, there's a better way of doing it.
Absolutely. Well, the bandwagon rolled on to Ewood Park for the final game of the season. Not a single loney in sight in that lineup. I said Josh Barrett, 17 years old, getting a game as well. Rob Dickey included as well in the squad, so fairly youthful look. And interesting one of Chris Gunter at left back and Gareth McCleary at right back, as it had been for the Preston game as well. What did you make of the final selection of the season? Should he have maybe put out a bit of a stronger side, or did you like the fact it was only players committed to the club?
I think it was players that were committed to the club. I've got no issue with that. We weren't going up, we weren't going down. You have to give start planning for next season. Interestingly, just going back to the Preston game, a point was made, and it's quite a valid point actually, that Gareth McCleary playing at right back against Preston was showing up the other three defenders by being the best defender on the pitch. I don't know what it was like at Blackburn, I didn't go, but by all accounts and looking at the goals that we conceded, obviously not well. But you know, going back to the original point, I suppose, no, I didn't have any issues with the fact that there were no low knees. Plan for next season.
Yeah, Hal Robson-Kanu, the only player really getting sort of a sniff that wouldn't be around the football club next season. I can't remember, were Cox and Ferdinand in the squad?
They didn't come on if they did, if they were. Because it was Dickie who came off as the defensive sub.
Yeah.
And he obviously, it was a glimpse into next season at the centre that this is what we've got.
I really hope
this is at the current moment, this is what we've got, this is what we're left with. And it was kind of interesting to see that because it shows how much we need. Because that was a pretty threadbare squad, even if you consider the fact that obviously a lot of them are academies. I wouldn't have bought any low knees, especially. Ola Johns drifted out of the side massively. Vidra just never really hit the heights. Obviously, there's a lot to be said about that. Are we sure that Della didn't get hold of Vidra and take him outside?
Oh, no. Take him down to the vets?
Are we sure?
Unconfirmed.
We'll have to get a sighting on Vidra to make sure he's back at Watford safe.
To be fair, Pearson and Hector had been recalled by Chelsea before the end of the season, haven't they? They've been already sent back to reintegrate ahead of Conte's arrival. So that only left one more, Andrew Taylor.
When people were saying why are we playing Gunter at left back, well, why would you play Taylor at left back? It's pretty irrelevant at the end of the day.
Yeah, so 3-1 to Blackburn. Reading go into an early 2-0 hole. They dig themselves back into contention with a Kermigan free kick for a late goal that finishes off. Is there anything to really take away from this game? I'll hold my hands up fully. I was 3,000 miles away and caught up with the Tarlest End's report and saw a couple of highlights, but
there was nothing to take from it. There was nothing to take from it before the game, and there's nothing to take from it afterwards. I mean, if we'd have won the game, then yeah, you just take the positive, to quote McDermott. But no, there was nothing in it, and roll on next season.
Yeah, winless in 8 to end the season, though, Mark. Is that worrying for you, or is it just a case of, well, it was a team in transition, it's going to be a completely different ball game next season, don't worry about it?
I kind of looked at it in an article on the website a few weeks ago. It sort of says if we're going to transist the whole squad into, 15 new signings or something stupid, then no, it doesn't matter, quite frankly. It never does when it's a new team and everything. If you relate it to how we finished last season on a similar sort of dull end, then, yeah, it's not a good momentum.
I thought beating Derby 3-0 was a fantastic end, personally.
Yeah, right, there was the comedy circus act at the end to sort of cheer everyone up, but...
That coming in the wake of a string of home defeats and general misery.
That also kind of gave us a bit of optimism that was profoundly didn't deserve to be there.
I think a large portion of the fan base tipped Tariq Fosu to be the next superstar based on that 60-minute cameo, and obviously we didn't see him for 1 minute in a Reading shirt in a competitive game this year.
That's something that we're going to touch on later.
Indeed. But just finally then, so as I mentioned at the top, Reading finished 17th at 2 points, 2 places better off than last season. Never really in any relegation bother, but well off the pace of the top 6 and certainly the top 2. My last question on this before we move on is, are you at all, if you're Brian McDermott right now, are you at all worried? Or do you think that the fact that we're sitting here now, what is it, a week and a bit after, means that his job's safe?
Depends on what you know. I think.
Do you know something, Dave?
There's a lot of rumour flying around, and it's informed rumour as well, as in the local press, about Ties wanting to sell. Certain people are saying the Ties don't have any money. They're not even asset rich, which I can't believe, being the businessman they are, personally. But certainly, there's an argument, and certainly swathes of people that I know are suggesting that they're certainly not cash rich. And it's a similar situation to what we found ourselves under Medeski after 2008. Again, he's asset rich but not cash rich, and so isn't able to physically put any money into the club. So I suppose it depends. With McDermott, we know he's been there before, so we know he can build a side under these circumstances. There's a question of what money there is coming into the club, and whether McDermott can do it all again.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating. We'll touch a lot more on the ownership in news bites and how we stand with that. But Mark, just on a result and sort of a looking ahead point of view, does Brian deserve to stay in the job? Was he dealt a harsh hand?
If we relate it to how obviously Clark got a nice little win at Derby at the end of last season, but I don't think it was any better an end for Clark last season than for McDermott this season, and no one was calling for Clark to be sacked. A lot of people have made their mind up on McDermott. In terms of results, you know, he could have won 5 out of 7, he could have drawn 1, lost 6. It's kind of irrelevant as to where we finish in the league. But I sort of agree with Dave. There's a lot of power battles. It feels like there's a lot of politics going on at Reading in the boardroom at the moment, and that will be the thing that determines whether he stays or not.
Yeah, lots of distractions, unfortunately. The Championship itself, that has all but wrapped up. We await the result of tonight's second leg of the playoff semi-final between Hull and Derby. I'm sticking my neck out here and saying I don't think Derby are going to overturn that 3-0 deficit. Unless, I'll tell you what, Nick Blackman scored 4. Make yourself a hero. How about that one?
Does love a good goal against Hull.
He does. No, I'm going to safely write Derby out of this. So it's going to be a Hull-Sheffield Wednesday playoff final. We already know 20 of the teams that are going to be in the Championship next season. We'll touch on that a little bit later on again as we look towards next season as well. But just overall, your thoughts on the Championship this season? Was it a strong league? Was it a weak league?
I think it was an exceptionally strong league for this division. And it's only going to get stronger. With Newcastle coming down and looking like Benitez is going to stay, that's a huge risk for Benitez. This is his neck on the line. Villa, I don't think, are going to be pushing anywhere near top six given the current situation. But it remains to be seen who they get as their manager. We've lost Borough.
We're going to lose one. I said one of Sheffield Wednesday and Hull. We've lost Burnley.
Strong sides.
Burnley are my team in this team of the season.
Burnley were streets ahead in terms of all-round gameplay, as it were. They could do pretty much anything. They could play it, knock it around nicely. They could play direct. They could grind a result out, and they can win handsomely. There were, as Championship sides go, Burnley had it pretty much nailed down to a T. They got the formula and they got it absolutely right. I mean, obviously signing Joey Barton, who won't be on a small sum of money for a season, and Andre Gray for reported 8 or 9 million or however much it was, will obviously help. But you know, they kept the core of their squad together that won that gained promotion 2 seasons ago. The majority of the players that gained promotion 2 seasons ago. Funnily enough, the majority of those players that played on the last season, 2014 at the Wadeski, were playing on the last day of the season at Charlton. So they've got it absolutely right. Middlesbrough obviously had it right, a little bit defensive for my liking. I'd obviously like Karanka as our manager if he was to get, you know, 1-0s and 2-0s, but at the same time I'd be a bit frustrated that we weren't a bit more attacking.
Yeah, especially with the players that they managed to invest in. I said that the likes of Ramirez, Jordan Rhodes.
They spent heavily. And you take a look at the playoffs. I mean, you've got Brighton. Brighton for me, all right, they've not spent so heavily, but their managerial appointment last season. And this is where Reading fans need to take a look, because Chris Hughton's a good manager. And for me, Brian McDermott's a good manager. Now, Chris Hughton's first 4 or 5 months in charge. I mean, when Brighton played at the Medeski in March last year, they were hopeless.
Yeah,
they were absolutely hopeless as far as I was concerned, and we should have won by 4 or 5 that day. The fact that we
2-1 wasn't it, Jamie Mackey?
Yeah, 2-1.
Yeah, yeah. Penalty to them.
But you know, they signed well in the summer. They kept the majority of their squad together, it has to be said. And obviously, we're not going to do that, but they signed well with Kyle. They got Anthony Knockar in January. Hemed, they signed well, Brighton, and that's the key to it. Is if you sign well, and with a little bit of patience as well,
yeah.
Because even though Chris Hughton wasn't there in January last year, the majority of that squad has been there for 4 or 5 years, and that's the key to it. With the exception of Sammy Hoopier, their managers stayed for 3 or 4 seasons. There's longevity, there's continuity there. And when they do replace, generally, Tony Bloom, when he does replace a manager, he generally gets it right. Yeah. Was a bit of a red herring.
But again, it was a team. It wasn't a collection of great individuals. Yeah. It was a team effort, and they were, you know, a bit similar to, I suppose, Reading, when they last won promotion, going up against you know, bigger sides and in Southampton and West Ham, and unfortunately for Brighton, they just didn't get over the line. And I'll tell you what though, Mark, one thing I don't buy this argument with is this sympathy card that's played for teams that finish third and don't make it through the playoffs. Everyone's saying, oh, well, they finished X amount of points above the team who knocks them out of the playoffs.
Bad luck, should have been better.
Exactly. What do you reckon?
And every Reading fan will say the team that finished second in 1995 had to go up through the playoffs that year and managed to sack it in the playoff final against Bolton. So,
well, yeah, but they knew that finishing second wouldn't be automatic promotion at the start of the season.
And
it wasn't
like
exactly
Bolton
sprung
them
after they finished second.
Yeah, so that's how it goes. Second was an anomaly year, and if that's not unfair, then third certainly isn't unfair.
So, just finishing up then, did Reading miss an opportunity this season, or was it almost a good year to be a bad side? Was there such competition that you're probably ducking out of a good championship race, or is this a missed opportunity?
There's ever a good year to be a bad side. I mean, as I said, the championship this year was exceptionally strong.
There's a lot of confused clubs as well hanging around the bottom. You've got like Blackburn, and then the absolute turmoil clubs like Charlton are going down. Make sure you're not a turmoil club and you can just about float around in 18th, 19th like we are. And yeah, with you can get a good run together, but it's only going to get harder. You've got teams like Forest, and they've got good players. So you think of it subjectively, and they have, you know, they're decent sides, and they're 12th in the 13th.
You're absolutely right. There's a number of different types of clubs. You've got the club that's absolutely desperate to go up and doing everything they possibly can in Derby, spending £26 million and then sacking their manager after 9 months. That's not the way to go. And then you've got, as I've alluded to earlier, Brighton. They're a club that they've got a lot of good going for them, and it's a matter of time before Brighton get promoted. Middlesbrough are exactly the same. The continuity with Karanka, and yes, they've spent heavily, they've invested heavily, and for me should have probably been walking the league. You know, again, Burnley continuity, they've had Sean Dyche in charge for 3 seasons now.
Well, Burnley and Norwich are kind of a new breed of yo-yo clubs. Like, they're seasoned promotion getters, and you have to come up against those, and they may not spend £25 million every year, but they will put together a side that will put together a playoff push at the very least. And there's only 6 places to go and only 3 places to go up. And
Cardiff as well. I mean, Cardiff is just outside the playoffs. They're a team not in transition, but they're just changing their philosophy slightly. They tried to spend heavily before, didn't they? And they got there, but obviously it all went pear-shaped in the Premier League with Solskjaer. Again, they didn't like Russell Slade. The fans didn't necessarily like Russell Slade. Start getting it together again the second half of the season. But then again, they're a side that have just, you know, booted him sort of upstairs after 18 months.
They, to me, could be Burnley of next season. Do you remember how Burnley came down after Coyle had taken him up? And they just sort of took a couple of years under Eddie Howe, didn't really figure it out, and then just suddenly clicked under Dyche. Cardiff could be one of those teams for me. Still getting parachute payments that can make the jump. But as I said, we'll focus on next season's championship a little bit more. But in the meantime, there are quite a few bits of news to get through. So let's move on to News Bites.
Reading News Bites on the Tarlhurst End podcast.
So, News Bites time, and because it is the end of the season, there is a fair bit of news to chew over. On our last show, we talked about the season ticket renewal prices, so that's all out in the open. I think we're going to skirt over the club picnic idea, as much as controversy.
Are we not recording the next podcast live from the club picnic?
Ooh, don't give me an idea, Mark.
I'd love to, but sadly, I am working.
Might as well, because I might be there.
Oh, well, there you go.
Take my boys down at the pitch.
Oh, there you go. So there you got a fan of the idea. But anyway, I said we're not going to talk about it, so we're not going to talk about it. This is my show, damn it, for at least a couple of hours. And if I'm allowed back next season. Right, meanwhile, news-wise, as mentioned, quite a lot to get through. We'll start with the big ones, which is contracts. And Reading have confirmed what we widely assumed, that on the senior contract front, Anton Ferdinand, Simon Cox and Hal Robson-Kanu will all not be offered new deals. Surprised at any of those three names, chaps?
I'm a little surprised we didn't make some sort of effort to keep Hal Robson-Kanu, like, in the public domain. I know there was talk of us offering him like a deal or whatever if he wanted to stay, but I'm surprised they didn't say we've offered him a deal and he may say yes or no. They have just cut it straight out and said he's gone, which is a bit of a surprise. The other two, not so much.
Dave?
No, not surprised at all. I don't think anybody can truly say how Robson Cunningham has earned himself a contract over the period of his previous one.
I'm going to disagree there. I thought he deserved a new contract, but I just don't think he's in anywhere near Reading's financial range. Well, sorry, for what he thinks he's worth, anyway.
Well, no, I don't think he. I don't think he's done.
Really?
I don't think he's done anywhere near enough. For them, if you're going to be a high earning player, then you've got to perform like a high earning player. And for two and a half, 3 years, he hasn't been a high earning player.
He
hasn't
played
like a high earning player. Well, yeah. Guess what? His contract was up at the end of the season. What's going to happen? We all know. We all know what happens with him. He flatters to deceive. And yes, he's played well this season, don't get me wrong. But last season, very much underwhelming. And season before that, again, very much underwhelming. Premier League, yeah, great. But he certainly had his detractors before we got promoted in 2012.
Very
all
true.
Right, he was developing. There's a, you know, and there's a reason why he's a bit of a running joke on this very show.
He does have an award named after him.
Well, there we go. There's a reason for that. You know, as much in jest as it can be. There's an element of truth to it.
The underachieve attack.
Exactly. He's underachieved, and he continues to underachieve. And after about six or seven seasons out of nine, or however many seasons he's played, out of professional contracts, is he actually underachieving?
He has got 30 goals in 226 Reading appearances, Mark. Now, obviously, a fair chunk of those, say 25% of those, are probably substitute appearances. But for a man who's worn the number nine shirt, do you agree with Dave? Do you think he's flattered to deceive, or are we going to miss out on these peak years?
Well, he's not going to have a peak year next year because the Euros is this summer, and he's getting ready for the Euros, and he obviously wants to impress, and he's fit now, and... You know, I think that was the only thing on his mind. Obviously, he wants to get a new contract somewhere. He's probably not so worried about that. But, he's...
What happens now, we can read this like a book, is that he has an absolutely... He's not got a contract offer at the moment, or presumably he's not got a contract offer. He goes to the Euros, he has a stonking Euros, and he gets himself a bumper three-year contract in the Premier League. For two of those years, he flatters to deceive. For the last season, he'll score 10 goals.
The problem is, for me, and
he'll get himself a new contract.
We're retreading old ground, but I'm going to retread it simply because it's our it's the last chance we'll probably ever talk about the lad. But he has all the attributes. He's still got all the attributes, and for me, it was so frustrating because at the first half of the season, before he got injured, and for me, it's no real surprise that Reading's form tailed off massively when he got injured, and admittedly at the same time as Tshabalala, and we saw the Sarr and Vidra combination broke up, but Rob Zakani was our leading assist maker. He was finally putting it together on the left. I think he scored two in the game that he got injured in.
Fulham, yeah.
Yeah. No.
It was injured against Fulham. He was taken off at half time, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was it. You are right. But before that, before his first injury, I think it was against Charlton, I think he'd put in a good performance, or Middlesbrough. Maybe Middlesbrough, because I think he set up the goal.
Yeah, he set up the first
Danny Williams' goal. And he was finally putting it all together. He was great run of form, and then he got injured, and it never really clicked for him after that. But, like I said, he's got all the attributes, and it would not surprise me. We've said it on Christmas. I remember on Christmas shows in the past when people have tipped him to bounce back. Would not surprise me at all seeing him really turn it on and make a career of itself. Likewise, though, Dave, like you, I could see him doing exactly as you said. Two seasons of flattering to deceive, and then put together one last contract.
Just the way that he's worked so far. You know, he's flattered to deceive in his progressive years up until 2012 when we got promoted. He had an absolute stonking season in a relegated side, and you know, even then he didn't get his bumper contract his move that he wanted in his bumper contract, did he? He ended up getting a bumper contract under Zingarevich, and then for two seasons out of the three-year contract, he was absolute pants.
Yeah, given that chance to play up front where he said he wanted to play and he didn't do it.
That season we finished seventh under Adkins was we'd just come down and it was really you're going to be the best player in this team right now. And you wouldn't have even put him in the top 11 for that season. And that is the one that everyone remembers because that was the flattery followed by the deception. And he's all during this phase he's done well for Wales, which has annoyed Reading fans, as you kind of expect. Sort of, yes or no. and you know, now it's come to a natural end. I think it's best for him that he moves on. He'll go and be a squad player at Watford or something, in my opinion. Maybe a Norwich or someone will pick him up and try and make him good, but I'm not sure he will be.
I can't see him down at Swansea, to be perfectly honest with you. I think he'll end up
they
in
are
Wales.
Repeatedly linked, and whether it's just lazy journalism because it's a Welsh club or not.
Do you think he does go to the Premier League? Do you think he's Premier League bound, or do you think he's going to be Championship?
I think some Premier League club's going to be a mug to get him.
Yeah,
I think he will end up in the Premier League.
Yeah, very good point. If he has a stonker game against England, then it's all said and done, isn't it? Yeah.
If he scores one goal at the Euros, then he'll go to the Premier League too. It's as easy as that.
If he scores against England, he'll go to a Premier League.
He'll go to Arsenal if he scores against England.
He started his career at Arsenal as a trainee, part of their youth system before coming over to Reading. Just a quick word on the other two then. Simon Cox, obviously a bright return when he first came back. He got those 8 goals before, you know, the turn of the year in his first season. It was looking like a great return. And then only scored 1 over his next year and a half.
I'm a bit disappointed for him. A complete flip side to Hal Robson-Kanu. Now, there are many people that might laugh at that, but Nigel Adkins played him in his right position, and he scored 7 goals under Nigel Adkins by Christmas. He was on for a 14-15 goal season. He was scoring goals, he was creating chances as well. He was doing well. Obviously, Steve Clarke doesn't like him. We know that. And as a result of that, his career, certainly his career at Reading, has seriously faltered. He's been given 2 or 3 games here and there, hasn't been given a run in the side. And that really, you know, for any player in any position, that stifles them. You know, you can't just give them 2 or 3. You know, you've got to give them the luxury of 6, 7, 8 games to prove themselves. And when you're putting them in for 2 or 3 games and then not playing them for the next 5 or 6, putting in for 2 or 3, you know, people turn around and say,
"Oh, he did kind of get a run right at the end of the season, though, didn't he?" And didn't quite take it. He obviously scored the goal at Borough, but apart from that,
it was a bit of a rock and a hard place, because he was coming back to a side that wasn't doing very well. So you think, here's a striker, let's give him a go. But then at the same point, he's out of contract at the end of the season. So you've got to, if you're going to give him a go, then you have to be willing to give him a contract if he takes it. I'm not sure the club were ever willing to give him a contract.
Is he still a championship quality player? We've seen him at Reading, and he had that spell at Bristol City where he couldn't get into a struggling team there. Do you think he pitches up at another championship club next year, or do you think he's got to go down again to maybe rebuild himself for one last push?
Maybe Scotland. SPL.
I'm sure Brendan Rodgers will take him at Celtic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think you're right. He's got to, in order to resurrect his career and get it back on track, it might be worth him dropping down a division to League One. He scored 30 goals for Swindon in League One. It was really, you know, announced his name on the scene, and he got his move to Swindon, and then his move to West Brom on the back of that. Is he championship quality? He's certainly not top-end championship quality, but he'd get into a Rotherham side.
If you look at where he played best for Reading, he played best for Reading when he was put alongside Glenn Murray. He's in a really good striker he could properly play off. And throughout the rest of his time at Reading, and certainly his time at Bristol City as well, he never really had that, did he? So maybe if he did go to a club that did have a prolific striker that was getting into those positions, he might do better, but he's got to think carefully. I do feel a bit sorry for him. He's a local lad, as the chant goes. He's one of our own. A player you absolutely want to root for, but just, unfortunately, just a man that had lost. And unfortunately, with the club's financial situation, again, that we'll come on to in a bit, that I just don't think you could gamble. You couldn't gamble on another contract for him, because he's coming to the age of
his... better out there.
Yeah.
There are better out there, let's be brutally honest. I mean, as unfortunate as it was, there are better strikers that we can go for.
Yeah. And you can say you give him a year, but he's not going to take a 1-year contract. He's in his 20s still, isn't he? So
yeah.
He's worth a 3-year contract somewhere.
He is. The one that slightly disappointed me, and only very slightly, was Anton Ferdinand, because I thought when Anton Ferdinand played this season, and admittedly, again, story of his Reading career, it wasn't often enough because he wasn't available enough. When he did play, he looked class. And at the start of the season, he had a really good partnership going with Paul McShane. I think he finished as one of our highest-rated players in the Tarleton player ratings. I think he finished with a 6.4 average, which, while not sounding spectacular, is quite good, considering the player of the season, Ali Al-Habsi, finished with a 6.1, I think, even. But was it just simply a case of you couldn't guarantee his fitness? Or do you think there was just something more... Was it age? Was it probably his wage demands? Combination?
Age and fitness, simple as that. as far as I'm concerned. I don't think there was anything more you could say. Yes, he was good quality, but he went a whole season and played 45 minutes of football.
Yeah, he played 26 games in all in his Reading career, two of those coming in his first season, so 24 games this season. Again, only half.
That's half the games. Yeah. You can't justify a player to play in half the games when, you know, a name like Anton Ferdinand should be looking to be first choice, and ultimately he's been usurped by Jake Cooper. I don't think Jake Cooper's anywhere near as good, and I don't think Jake Cooper will ever be anywhere near as good as Anton Ferdinand. But when you only play half the games, you can't turn around and say, yeah, I felt I deserve more an extension to my contract.
You know, I wrote in my report cards for the defence that you can go read up on thetalisten.com. We're going through position by position. I wrote that if Reading could find a player like him, a younger, fitter version like him, it'd be perfect. But then again, Reading probably can't afford a younger, fitter player with those qualities. I think the only reason they get someone like a Ferdinand is because they've got flaws. And in Ferdinand's case, it was, I don't think he'd played a game in England for, was it something like 18 months before he arrived?
He'd gone to Thailand, which is very strange.
He was sort of weirdly linked to Samrit, wasn't he?
Yeah, with Police United, I believe it was. And he turned up as well and ended up with us, weirdly. I have a feeling it was the same with Cox, is that if he would have played every game he was available for this year, he probably would have tipped 30 appearances, because he was on the bench for a lot in the second half of the season. And I think the club, again, had just decided that they weren't going to give him a contract. They were going to hedge their bets on Cooper, rightly or wrongly. That has, you know, ended up with Cooper not progressing, whatever. But Ferdinand wasn't in the team, and they just made their minds up probably around January that he was just not worth playing.
Away from the senior side, then, a host of academy players released. I'm not going to go through the full list here. You can go onto thetalisten.com and check out the list. The only real thing I wanted to bring up with it is that there were a lot of names that you were seeing in that under 21 Premier League Cup win, in that Youth Cup run. Is it a bit of a wake up call to fans not to expect too much of these academy players? You know, it's all very well and good the team having success, but does this just go to show how hard it is to make that step up?
Yes. Ultimately, when you have a youth team, you'll be lucky if you get one, maybe two players making the step up from under 21 football to first team football within a particular age group. And that goes not just for Reading, but for absolutely any club. So we might end up with the odd gem, and I think Tariq Fozu is certainly showing the signs. Craig Tanner is showing the signs. Jack Stacey is showing the signs. But whether or not they actually make the step up to Championship football, it's a massive, massive step up.
Yeah,
what anybody says.
Big name. Well, I say big name. Piers Sweeney, Mark, was a player that arrived from Ireland, got a good reputation, was named, I think, the Irish Under 21 Player of the Year.
Yeah, a number of times, I think.
Yeah, a couple of years ago now, and seemed to be a big potential, but he just got overtaken by Jake Cooper and just didn't make it.
Yeah, he was very much expected last season to be the fourth choice centre-back, and that ended up being Cooper, and neither of them had gone out on loan, and it's really hard to tell how good these players are before they go out on loan. It's a bit superfluous, but we think about players like Robson Kanu, Carrachan and Pierce, all went out to relatively decent clubs on loan, certainly in League One and above.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, Pierce Sweeney never had that chance to prove himself for whatever reason. It's so hard to know with these young players.
Might be because clubs at League One, League Two level didn't think he was good enough.
Exactly, and mentality wise it's so hard for us to know. So, you know, it's hard to really work out, I think.
Yeah, and contract offers are pending for a number of more familiar names, the likes of Aaron Corwitt.
And we say about that step-up, sorry, Evans, the lad from Walsall, played excellently well for Walsall in League One, came to the Championship with us a week later, and he was miles off the pace. And it shows there's a massive jump between every league. And we kind of take it for granted sometimes when we've seen the likes of Sigurdsson and Long come in and take it in their stride, that those were top, top players. As much as I hate saying top players, and it's hard to find those.
Yeah, Paul Brayson, man who broke all sorts of youth records at Newcastle, pitches up at Reading in Division 1 then, and then into Division 2, and was absolutely useless.
One goal in 50 appearances.
Yeah, he was
He's the best example I can think of someone that has absolutely raked at a youth level and then gone into senior football. And just,
I think Paul Brayson was, I want to say unlucky in some ways, but at the same time, he rarely fashioned a chance, or he was rarely given a chance in terms of chances, goal scoring chances on a pitch.
I remember my funny one was against Notts County. Do you remember at home? He sort of scored. I think they got given his own goal. It sort of bounced off, kicked into a defender or something, and just looped over the keeper.
Notts County. It was Ian Richardson when he just
that was
he,
it.
Ian Richardson, a bouncing, just an innocuous bouncing ball back to his keeper that he decided to head back, and the keeper was coming out. Brayson had a goal disallowed in that game, and I have seen the highlights back on. I think it was a period of time where the club were putting some highlights on of past games on the website, and I did see it, and that was there, and I couldn't see any sign of a foul anywhere. It was given for a foul on the goalkeeper, but apart from that, you know, he had the odd chance, and I remember when we were at Fulham, we went 1-0 up early on with Grant Brebner scoring.
Loved
and about a minute later. Brayson was put through on goal just to keep it a beat, and he spaffed the chance. And you're just thinking that with Brayson, it might have just been a case of one goal would have just kick-started him, but it just didn't arrive, it didn't occur. One goal he did get was in a 3-1 defeat at Wolves, just after he signed.
Effectively relegated us, didn't it?
All intents and purposes, yeah. We went to Forest a week later, and he hit the post in that game, actually. We'd have won that game, we were still within a chance. And then Chris Bart-Williams relegated us and won them the championship, or the Division 1 as it was.
Relegated alongside Manchester City and Stoke.
Yes, who played off against each other the last day.
Indeed.
Yeah, Man City won 5-2, if I remember rightly.
You are indeed. Anyway, you know this show's... you know Reading have had a good season when we have to bring up Paul Brayson and... innocuous games against Notts County in 1999.
On the same day, Elm Park's last day. God rest its soul.
Indeed. Anyway, back to present.
Bastard.
Oh, indeed. I'm going to leave that in. I'm going to leave in this swear because it's the end of season special. We're in a pub, so you should expect some coarse language. Anyway.
Paul Brayson's probably serving at the bar.
No, I saw Paul Brayson play for Northwich Victoria about 6 years later when they played Lancaster City in the FA Cup. And they gave him barrels of stick. And you must have thought, who's this guy? Why is he just picking on me?
How's he heard of me?
Yeah, exactly. Needless to say, he was still overweight. But he won the FA Cup Player of the Round twice. You know, he's the only, I think, possibly the only player to ever do so.
He actually scored an absolute shed load of goals for Northwich, didn't he?
He got two seats to Wembley for the final because of that. Anyway, we've completely gone off track. A host of academy releases and a new contract offers, which you can go and read on thetalesend.com. Moving on, we touched on the ownership situation earlier. Lots of mounting speculation, more due to the silence of our Thai owners than anything else. And as Dave mentioned, lots of different rumours flying around. Again, it's all 100% speculation at this stage. We've got no concrete evidence of anything really, but the owners then came out with a statement to end the season, and you can read it in full up on the full Reading website. But you know, some of the highlights, they said that, you know, they feel the same disappointment as fans, highlighting that it was a very frustrating league campaign for them. They say they've still got high expectations, and those expectations obviously weren't met last season. The ambition is still to get in the Premier League. They make a point of pointing to the investment they made at the start of the season and talking about the transition that will need to be in place for next year with the 6 lower players going back. They said change is inevitable and we'll need to build and bind together a new squad capable of challenging at the top end next season. And they say despite the obvious disappointment of the season, our commitment to the club grows stronger. Off the pitch, exciting new preliminary plans for Royal Elm Park have been put in place while the wheels have been set in motion for our new training ground development at Bearwood. Football, of course, is the driving force behind our involvement at Reading Football Club. Investment in long-term projects like these is crucial if we are to successfully lay the foundations for a sustainable future for the club. And on that theme, our academy continues to be a beacon for others to follow. Yada, yada, yada. Now the season's come to an end. We'll have to cast aside any negativity and collectively move this club forward together as one with a renewed spirit and passion. The Premier League is where we want to see Reading Football Club. Have you ever read a more... am I being cynical?
No, you're not being cynical. There are a lot of words there to tell us stuff that we don't already know or that we don't already expect. So fair play for them to coming out with it. I mean, let's face it, they've been incredibly silent for the best part of 6 months now. And certainly at the start of last season, they were, you know, almost
trumpeted fanfares when they were at the club. So the club knew that the ties needed to say something, and I think the ties have basically pandered to the fans there and basically said a lot of stuff that people want to hear. What does it actually tell us? Not a great deal. We knew about Royal Elm Park. We know about Bearwood. We know we have 6 loan players, 3 players out of contract, so that's 9 players out. We know we're going to have a transitional season. What we also know is that there are a number of youth team players coming in, and they're going to be somewhat relied upon next season. I'm getting the impression that there isn't a great deal of money flying around. I think we will see more players leaving, certainly for fees. I think you'll be looking at the likes of Danny Williams, Ollie Norwood, being sort of prime targets. Maybe Chris Gunter if he has a particularly good Euros.
Jake Cooper as well has been linked with the Premier League sides.
Yeah, and you know, but, yeah, well, yes, it's going to be transitional. Yes, there's going to be a number of players coming in. But tell us something we don't know, kind of thing, you know?
Absolutely. Mark, the big worry for me, I mean, I've written an extensive piece up on the Tarlow Stand a couple of weeks ago, looking at the energy situation and bringing together all the sort of information and public soundbites that we had. And my overwhelming, you know, I ended the piece basically by saying that for me, the ties have given us a lifeboat. They certainly rescued the club from almost certain administration and have put the club back on soundish financial footing. You know, they've debts are under control and whatnot. But I wrote, they've put us in the lifeboat, but there's not the sign of the shore at the moment. There's been no guarantees, and I'm a little bit nervous. Have you got any nerves about this group at the moment?
I'm not nervous that we're going to be sitting here next season without a club to support, or with a club that's been docked 10 points and thrown down to League One or even League Two. I think more that we're going to see a kind of replication of the Badeski era, that we're going to be selling players as and when we can, sort of like Blackman. I think Norwood and Williams will go this summer. And that we'll be signing players who are like Dennis Raquel's, and that can be good. Raquel's has been a bit hit and miss, but it can work. Obviously, we know it's worked in the past for Reading. But there's the pressure on the academy increases again, because that's got to create funds for players to sell and players to do well. There's pressure on the manager, and we've seen that they've sacked a manager already.
Sacked two managers.
Exactly, yeah, so they have a happy trigger finger. There's just a lot of uncertainty as to where the club's going to go. In terms of finances, I don't think anything massive's going to happen. I don't think they're going to splash £2.5 million on a loan either. I think they might be scared off by that. But
I think, and I'm just thinking off the cuff here, there's a bit of a worry in my mind that they're sensitive to criticism. They're sensitive to negativity around the place. Now, you look at what happened with Nigel Adkins, the clamour for Adkins to ultimately be sat, and particularly after, you know, it's hard to disagree with the decision in the end, coming off the back and after a 6-1 defeat, a side that had conceded 8-6 weeks previously on the same ground. But the clamour to sack Nigel Adkins was quite vociferous. Steve Clarke made his own bed, and the clamour to sack him after that QPR game. There are arguments, and that it was far too soon. You can see why they've done it, but again, it's on the back of criticism. They've started receiving a bit of criticism about going quiet over the last 5 or 6 months, and it's growing and growing and growing. And suddenly, we find at the end of the season, there's a statement that comes out like that. Now, the one thing I suppose, and that statement that does strike me in that statement, is that they've actually committed themselves in writing for perpetuity by saying that their commitment to the club grows stronger. Now, they've now got to stand by that. They've got no choice but to stand by that. How that commitment manifests itself, there are a lot of people that are going to turn around and say that it'll be financial commitment. There were some people that would turn around and say there's got to be building block commitment. I mean, how exactly does that commitment manifest itself? How do they view it? This is the problem with the club at the moment, is that there is no true firm communication in terms of guidance in the direction that the club and everybody at the club is pulling.
Yeah.
And it strikes me at the moment is that, that you have like three individual shareholders and maybe Sam Ritt also pulling strings. Let's face it, he was fundamental
If anything, I think Sam Ritt's no longer pulling any strings. He's obviously got legal troubles back in Thailand. So if anything, I think that might be one of the reasons why they've gone quieter, because they haven't
got
a football brain left on in the group.
Who knows what happens in the Far East? I mean, there are rumours at Birmingham that Carson Young has still got ties into Birmingham City. From a prison cell, believe it or not.
I can just imagine him getting like slid like a piece of paper under a cell door. We've had an offer in for Clayton Donaldson from Reading. Do you want to accept?
Yawn to our third minute 1-0.
He's got like sneak out, kissing his wife or something
again,
like that.
There's no substance to that, but it's just a few bits and pieces.
Indeed. If you're listening, Carson, don't sue us.
And I just wonder if Sam Ritt's got the same. But at the same time, you know, you take a look at someone club stalwart like Nick Hammond leaving.
Yeah.
Nick Hammond wouldn't have left. I mean, he turned down Arsenal, for Christ's sake. He's gone to West Bromwich Albion.
To be a technical director as well, which is a slightly different role.
With Tony Pulis, who's never wanted one.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that there are a lot of egos at the club, at the top end, and they're all pulling in different directions. Again, as I was alluded to earlier, politics are playing. And not tearing the club apart, but certainly stretching the fabric to a tension that we don't really want, need.
You've got such a confusing structure. You've got Nigel Howe openly admitting, well, I'm the one in charge of day-to-day stuff. You've still got a on-paper co-chairman in Sir John Medescu, who's historically had the biggest influence in the club. You've obviously got these three different shareholders. You've then got all their various advisors. You've still got other people around the club, you know, board members and whatnot. You've obviously got managers. You did have Nick Hammond, who's gone now. It's just an absolute confusing mess. You don't know who's controlling the purse strings. And they talk about the investment they've made in the football club. And I will just say this. Reading have still been receiving these parachute payments. The big acid test for me will come at the end of next season when these parachute payments stop. Because from that point on, if Reading is to be anywhere near competitive, with the gates that they get and the money that's going to be coming into the football club, they are either going to have they're going to have some sort of outside source of revenue. They're not just simply going to be able to balance the books by, you know, paying down the contracts. Because 10 million is a lot of money to get in outside revenue from the Premier League. And as soon as that goes, and I put it in my piece, and Narin, in a comment in the pre-season tour last year, said if the club keeps losing money at the rate it was losing, then we're going to have to find, they're going to have to find new owners. Which says, sums up to me perfectly, that they are not here to prop up a failing football club. They're not here as a vanity project, like, say, at Leicester, or we've seen at Manchester City, or Sheffield Wednesday, where the owner wants a successful football club. That's what they've come in for. They've come in for the football. It's quite clear, and they can say whatever they want, but it's very clear to me that they've come here primarily as part of a property deal. There's the very fact that Royal Elm Park has been going through, and the plans are apparently submitted before they even finalised. The plans were drawn up before the takeover was finalised. And it's a property deal that could be worth hundreds of millions of pounds. You talk about, what is it?
Question is to who, too?
Exactly.
Is it to the club?
Exactly that.
Yeah. Does it come via the money go to the ties and then a little bit gets drip fed
and
to
they
the
have
club?
Been, exactly. They have been very clever when asked directly by the press and in these statements to not mention it. They've never said that this is a deal designed to raise money for the club. They've said in that statement that all these outside sources are important to grow the club's revenue streams, which I very much agree with. But if Reading Football Club are getting 10% of the revenues from this, then it's going to be, again, as I wrote in this piece, that Reading basically would have mortgaged their future to stay alive for two or three seasons, because the next people that take over the football club are not going to have land around the stadium to develop. So if they had that in mind as a revenue stream, it's gone.
This is the thing, that the club has sold the stadium to the Ties, I believe, and various things like that.
Everything's gone. Everything has gone to
Tyreship. Certain things, like the hotel's still with Medeski or something like that.
I don't think so. I think that's gone as well.
But this is the thing, it's so murky as to when new owners come in, are they going to be buying a football team? Are they going to be buying a piece of land next to a football team, or both? And where's that money going to go? Is it actually going to be successful? Are we going to hit a property crisis in the next year when the Ties find that the land's worth nothing? There's so many variables, and I do sort of fear that...
I don't think we'll find the land's worth nothing, because by all accounts, they paid £11 million for the land.
Yeah. Absolute steal. Absolute steal. And in terms of Reading property crisis.
Exactly. It's pretty clear, and you're absolutely right, that they're in it for a property deal. They turn around and say that the football side of things is part and parcel. Don't buy that at all. The football side of things is, as far as I'm concerned, a byproduct.
But there's nothing. The thing is, though, there's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. If they've come for a property deal,
provided that they keep that side of it, they've got to keep that going as a community asset. But if they're there to just asset strip the land away, develop it, and then sell without any input for the finances from the takings of that property development going back into the club, there's a problem there. There's a fundamental problem there, and I think that they will find that they won't be welcome back in the town.
And the painful thing about it is, as you found out with Zingarevich, is that there's very little you can do. I mean, fans can make noises for the owners to make their intentions clear, but they can do that.
They hold all the cards.
Exactly.
I think if the fans get angry with the Ties will just become even more quiet.
Yeah.
They won't come out and stand on the pitch when there's a massive 40-foot banner saying get out of our town.
I don't think Sasa will be writing us a song again.
Yeah, exactly. It's just receipt.
The Swiss Ramble, which is their website, I very highly recommend. They do a lot of good analysis on the finances behind football. They did a piece looking at Bournemouth's rise through the leagues and how they've done it. And
fairy tale.
Yeah, it's basically down to heavy investment from their Russian benefactor.
Well, we know that their accounts were released recently, and they
lost
30 odd million quid, exactly, which is three times their flipping takings.
But again,
yeah, fairy tale. 10,000 fans.
But this is the scary thing, because Reading.
Is it any wonder we didn't end up with Callum Wilson when they're throwing money at you like that?
But again, I mean, but that's not a problem, because their benefactor is quite happy to chuck the money in and write it off. And I've got no problem with that.
And then they end up with a fine on FFP terms as well. Have they paid that?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, well, hello QPR, there's a precedent.
Well, they're still tied up in the courts. But it's going off track, but I've got no problem with that, because it's the same thing that Jack Haywood did, it's the same thing that Jack Walker did at Blackburn. If somebody wants to spend their own money on a football club, Sheikh Mansour, someone wants to pour their own money into a football club, good for them. Because it's the only way that smaller teams ever challenge the big boys, because the big boys are constantly getting the money from the Premier League and the Champions League.
And that's one of the detrimental factors of FFP. But at the same time, how many clubs? The number of clubs that have actually managed to sustain that is actually quite few. And most clubs have sensibly managed their downward trend, as it were. Now, Reading clearly aren't, or clearly haven't, should I say. Zingarevich managing the downward trend was to throw more money at Royston Drenthe. But certain clubs, you end up with, you know, the obvious extreme examples are Portsmouth, the Leeds,
those were clubs borrowing money they didn't have, and the same with Zingarevich. Zingarevich borrowed money against potential future success. By all accounts, Bournemouth, Man City, Leicester, it's just their own money they're happy to chuck in the football club. And
they do actually have money, that's the difference.
And as long as those clubs, as long as it's not debt, as long as it's not just debt that's piling up and they intend to do a runner, fine by me. As long as you're not saddling the football club when you decide to go away. But it's a side issue, but it's one we're going to have to keep a very close eye on. And unfortunately, that's all we can do for the time being. They don't have to publish their accounts until towards the end of the year, so that's going to be a fascinating
December
read.
December time, isn't it?
Yeah, when they publish their first accounts, because that will be the first time we get an idea of what the debt stands at for Reading Football Club, where the debt is held and at what factors. And at that point, we'll have a much better...
And we can compare it to the 96% turnover to salaries ratio that we had at the end of 2014-15.
Exactly.
So we want to see that go down. I really, really
do. Well, it's going to have to, because again...
Otherwise, it's over 100%. And that's just...
Well, which was a figure achieved by, I think they were saying most of the championship, again, in this very same article. I retweeted it earlier today, and we're recording this on a Tuesday, so go check that out. So we've covered a lot there. Just very quickly before we move on to the mailbag, the club's official player of the season was confirmed. Ali El Habsi was the one fans voted for the winner.
Not even first choice for all the season, but two seasons on the trot, we've had a goalkeeper as our player of the season. That tells its own story.
Did he deserve it, though?
I think so. Did anybody else deserve it, really?
Well, I don't think anyone else nicked
it off them. I think there is an argument for Ollie Norwood, but you know, he played almost every game at a reasonably consistent level, but it was far from well beaten.
Okay, here's an argument for it, a slightly controversial one. If Ali El Habsi deserves it basically purely on the back of a good second half of the season, why doesn't Nick Blackman deserve it for an even better first half of the season?
He's no longer with us. Yeah. Sold him.
No, but I know, but if Robert Fleck won it for Norwich when he was running there.
If he was still with us, then he'd have won it hands down. If he'd have scored another 8 goals or 5 goals even in the second half of the season, he'd have strolled away with it. But because he left, it showed how bad everyone else was. I mean, we've had to give it to a goalkeeper who's been problematic for the majority of games.
I think El Habsi's been... don't get me wrong, I think he's really come on since that first half of the season. But you can't ignore how bad he was. He got us knocked out of the League Cup, cost us several games, nearly got us knocked out of the League Cup 2 or 3 times before he eventually howled it up against Everton. He was awful. He dropped a ball into the net. It possibly cost Steve Clarke his job against QPR. And even we're talking in the last game of the season against Preston, he's not commanding his defence. Are you convinced that El Habsi's the answer? Because I was just saying, well, he had, if you take in his whole body of work, I think he had maybe a slightly above average season for a goalkeeper.
I'm not convinced he's the answer. I think you always feel there's a mistake in him, and much the same as we did with Federici, although Federici was it wasn't as frequent. But you know, there are better keepers out there. But at the moment, he's our number one, and currently, how long's his contract?
He's got another year to go. Yeah,
And you've got Jonathan Bond on a 3-year contract. They're the two keepers that we've got.
They're not going anywhere.
Ollie Norwood and Paul McShane also making the top three. We've mentioned Nick Blackman, but any other names deserved contention, or was it just again, not a strong season of candidates?
Not a strong season.
No, McShane was there by default.
Yeah.
McShane didn't do anything to deserve being in that.
It's 100% wholehearted, McShane, and you know, club captain as well, led by example.
Except for the Middlesbrough game.
Well, yeah, he made a few errors here and there, giving the penalty away against Preston. In fact, partly at fault for all three goals that we conceded against Preston throughout the season. Apart from that, I can't really see that he had a particularly bad season. It's just everybody else around him.
Yeah, we're running the Tyler Send Rookie of the Year award up on the website. Still got a bit of time to vote. I think we'll close that at the end of the week. But Aaron Tischbowler running away with it.
Deservedly so. He was class when he came in. Even on the first game of the season against Birmingham, I wonder what would happen if he had cracked that shot off the underside of the bar and into the back of the net, which would have brought us back to 2-2.
If he hadn't got the injury.
But it smashed off the line. And then, yeah, we got his injury, so... He could very easily have got player of the season if he'd been fit earlier.
There was a very small list of candidates. There's a specific set of criteria. Basically, you had to have played less than 5 games for Reading coming into the season and still be under, I think it was 22 or 23 on the first day of the season. So the only other candidates were George Evans, Dennis Raquels, and somebody else I'm forgetting, Jonathan Bond. Yeah, so that surprised me in itself, Dave. There were actually a lot of rookies in this squad. For all the talk of the academy at the end of last season and for the seasons before it, you didn't actually see a lot of academy products really around the squad.
No, but then I think we were always going to see a significant shift in personnel at the end of last season, and that bore fruit at the end of August. And we ended up with six loanees as well. Presumably, most of those will have had some kind of clause that was either detrimental to the club or advantageous to the player within their agreement. And when you've got so many loan players which clearly imbalances the squad, it's short-termism and it restricts the number of chances that supposed rookies have. loanees, as far as I'm concerned, was the main reason.
On the loanee front then, any of those six you'd like to see back at the Benassi Stadium anytime soon?
Would you take Hector for another season? Because he's going to go on loan next year.
No, move on.
You could happily move on from him, get someone else. Piazon, no. Vidra, no. Fernandez.
You say Vidra, no. I would absolutely have Matty Vidra back next season.
We'd have to pay another $2 million, though.
Well, if you didn't have to pay $2 million for him and Watford were going to pay a chunk of his rate, I'd 100%, because he is a player waiting to burst into form with the system.
Matty Vidra, up until the beginning of this season, was every bit as good a player as Fernando Forestieri, who has shone at Sheffield Wednesday. And I, like you, would happily have him back tomorrow.
I don't think he could possibly be as bad as he was last season.
No.
It's one of those...
The thing with him is that even though he was missing the chances, he was continually getting into the positions. And I think with a full pre-season here, say we sign him tomorrow, with a full pre-season at this club, there's no question that McDermott would get the best out of him and
build a system around him.
Exactly. And like he's proven that he's done on three or four occasions already, he'll build a system around a specific player or two, and we'd see. There's no question that he won't be as bad as his finishing won't be as bad as this season.
No. Who are the others? Taylor and Ola John.
Ola John is an interesting one, because every time he looks really good, then he'd be back on the bench. And you think, why is he on the bench? And that's because when he starts, he only plays 60 minutes. When he starts, he's not fit enough, basically. And again, it's a question of, if we're going to get Vidra back, you have to pay for him, because he's going to go Udinese or Granada, in my opinion. If you're going to get John back, you're going to have to either buy him outright, which is a massive risk, given that he's flattered to deceive for his career for the majority.
And he cost Benfica, what, €10 million?
He's got like a €20 million lease clause, which is just out of this world. So we're going to have him back on loan.
If Reading spend €20 million on a player in the next 2 years, I will...
Combine for all the players...
I'll present
this
show
in
my underpants. Which is very good for a podcast, because you won't have to see that.
But yeah, he'll be on loan again, and we'll have exactly the same problems. And he's another one who, if he'd have outplayed his full potential this year, he could have been player of the season, but he's not even close.
There's no question that he's a player that potentially excites fans, and he's shown it in periods where certain circumstances that he can do that, but he's just... It's flat to deceive for the majority of the season. And again, admittedly, he hasn't necessarily been given the starting chances. He's had three or four starts here and there, come off the bench three or four times, been out of the squad because of the six loanees. And yeah, then let's not forget he had that little bit of a temper tantrum in the middle of winter at Hull when he wasn't in the squad at all, when he tweeted big joke and then deleted it. There's an element of temperament there. I mean, he's Dutch, that's always going to happen.
They're all controversial. I apologise to our Dutch listeners.
I just think Ola John is a bit too close to Royston Drenthe for my liking, really.
Yeah, and I think if there was any intention...
Without the ego.
Yeah, if there was any intention for Reading to sign players like that, I think they would have been around the squad at the end of the season. Yeah. So I think that's it. Anyway, we've gone 45... I think that's comfortably our longest news bites ever, as we've gone 45 minutes for there. It sort of turned into a quasi-pub chat. So what we'll do is we will roll into the mailbag, and then any other thoughts on the season as a whole we'll try and throw in at the end. But as I said, it's time to get to your thoughts for the end of the season. Let's get the mailbag.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/ the Tarlhurst.
So welcome to the second hour of our end of season show, and we'll get underway with the mailbag. But just worth referencing that as we record this, Derby now 2-0 up at Hull. So having written them off right at the start of the show, I could be made to eat my words coming into this podcast, and would certainly rank as the greatest playoff comeback ever.
Yeah, well, I'd warn Derby fans not to get too excited about coming back from 3-0 down to each 3-2 in a playoff game. You will concede a penalty in the last 10 minutes and it will all end badly.
Needless to say, they will know their fate by the time this comes out, because it's not going to come out on Tuesday night, I'm telling you now. Right, so we do have a, not the biggest mailbag ever, I think a sort of a sign of the sort of apathy towards the season. I'd like to think so anyway, that or we've driven off all our listeners with our criticisms of the nation of Holland, or the Netherlands, sorry, and whatnot. So,
well, for no apologies.
He does offer no apologies, unreserved. Anyway, right.
Meant every word of it.
He did. And Matt Williams starts off the mailbag pretty much by summing up what I've just said. He says, I've listened to you all season, often contributed. The fact on your big end of season roundup, I literally can't think of anything to say. Probably speaks more about the season and the club and its current state than anything else. Well, thanks, Matt. You contributed anyway. So by not contributing, you still contributed. So hats off to you. Daniel Harrington says, the best opportunity in years for youth to break through, squad in full transition and no big budget for replacing. Agree?
Sounds like 2009 all over again. Yep, absolutely agree.
Brendan Rodgers' dynamic new era with Scott Davis.
Oh yeah, free kick specialist.
Yeah, and
scored the free kick against Chelsea and played three games after that before going on.
Does that mean we're going to lose 3-0 at Newcastle on the first game of the season?
Probably. No, the Newcastle game will be away on a Tuesday night just to spite us, as will the Brighton game inevitably
in December.
Indeed. Yeah, no, I agree. They're not going to get a better chance than this, especially with players like Fosu, Samuel, etc. coming back as well. So there'll be like new signings. I can hear the sound bites being trotted out now. Ollie Allen, one of our assistant editors, has said, what is the position you think we need to strengthen the most this summer?
All of them. There is not one position where I wouldn't sign a new player.
But there's got to be one. There's got to be one that sticks out.
The most important, striker.
Yeah, I'm with you. Dave?
Wide players.
Really?
Wide players, yep. Who have we got? Tariq Fosu, Gareth McCleary.
Oh, no, no, you're forgetting about the dynamic force that is Paulo Hurtado.
Still
ready to do a Bobby Convy and show us after a disappointing first season that he's got what it takes.
I would happily shake his hand at the end of next season if he does that. I can't see it, though.
No.
The challenge is there, Paulo, if you can understand me.
Indeed. Jack Stacey's coming through as well. Craig Tanner possibly
Quinn
as well as a wide option.
Quinn is a left winger, basically.
No, stop playing Quinn on the left. Stop it. He's a central midfielder.
I agree.
Yeah, wing is a very good shout as well. I will stick to my strikers for the time being.
That's exactly the reason why McDermott was playing a diamond formation. It was the best formation for us, albeit restrictive.
I'll bring this up here. What has happened to Gareth McCleary? Is Gareth McCleary done? Have we seen the best of Gareth McCleary now? He's got 1 year left on his contract. He's going to be away with Jamaica likely this summer as well for the Copa Centenary.
I think there's a lot more to come from him. I think he's not necessarily played within himself, but has been restricted by formation. And certainly, to a degree, I think he's a known name in the Championship as a player with an end product, and therefore gets treatment.
Hmm.
You know, due respectable treatment from opposition teams.
Back-to-back underwhelming seasons, though.
He's also had back-to-back no pre-season. For the first pre-season after Adkins finished seventh,
back surgery,
he broke his back. In the pre-season, just coming up to this one, he had two calf injuries at once.
Yeah, well, he went to the Copa and the Gold Cup with... Yep. Apparently played through several hamstring issues.
And Steve Clark was not happy.
No. Exactly. So he's got to have a full pre-season this year. Needs one.
I just found it slightly interesting that Brian McDermott didn't deploy him as a right winger and didn't try a 4-4-2 towards the end of the season.
It comes down, I'm just thinking, it probably comes down to balance, because he had a right winger, but did he have a left winger?
No, very true. Very true.
You know, you could argue, as I mentioned earlier, you could play Stephen Quinn there, but...
Or Raquel's maybe, or...
Didn't necessarily fit into the formation. Don't know.
Anyway.
Having him at right back is a reasonable amount of intent as well that he's going to try and attack. So I suppose in that...
That's true.
Right,
you never playing know. The diamond, the full-backs are expected to get forward. And certainly in the first two games that we played at Bolton and home to Forest, you can see that they were almost up with the centre of that diamond anyway.
There's no way McCleary's going to play there ahead of Guns, though, is there?
Oh, not next season, no chance.
No. He's a good backup option to know he can play there. But
it's like Carachan playing right back in friendlies back in the
Goodison.
Day.
Goodison.
You know, J-Tab. We always
J-Tab
like that.
J-Tab a right back, left footed. Excellent. Notorious, who helps do our away day videos. He says, for Championship standard, who would be your ideal strikers for next year? I'm not having a go, but I hate questions like this because it's completely dependent on who's available, what money Reading have got to spend, and stuff. I suppose I'll reframe the question slightly, and I apologise. If you go into the season with Dom Samuel, Jan Kermigan and Dennis Rackles, how many more strikers do you need, and how good is that as a core of three? Do you need a real top line striker, or do you just need someone else in to support the group?
It's a mid-table striking lineup, isn't it? As far as I'm concerned, totally unproven, but you know, on paper it's mid-table at the absolute maximum. He might get 15 goals out of Raquel's. He might have an absolute barnstorming pre-season and end up knocking 25. I can't see it, though, not from what we've seen so far.
I would struggle to see 15 goals out of him.
15 goals, you know, again, you've got 15 goals potentially from Kermigan. Keeps getting into the right positions. He's incredibly strong in the air. Dom Samuel scored 7 goals for Gillingham this season.
And then
side at the top
two
end of
in his
League
last
one.
20, so he's finished the season poorly like Gillingham have, so... It's hard. What kind of striker would I want in amongst that? You've got your target man. You've got a bit of pace. Maybe a finisher. Maybe a bit
I want the pace. I want the pace again. I want a nippy Forster-esque striker that can really stretch, and Shane Long-esque that can stretch that back line.
Yeah, Kieran's still playing. Sign him up.
Get him back.
He's got been playing in the champ in
League Two.
No, he's been relegated with Dagenham, hasn't he?
Alongside Dom Higham, running. Loney.
Yes. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. Although on the other side, they've been replaced by Cheltenham, who had Rob Dickey in part of their defence for this season. So
he scored a hat trick.
He did. The good and the bad of the Reading Loneys this season.
Get him up for now.
We'll profile all of the Loneys on our final end of season loan report in the next couple of weeks once the playoffs are wrapped up. Because obviously Tarek Fosu and Craig Tanner both have not Tarek Fosu anymore, but Craig. Or does he? Yeah, because you're still in it as we record this, aren't we?
They've not been their second leg.
No, they've still got to play Wimbledon again. Sorry, I've knocked them out prematurely.
Tomorrow night?
Quite possibly. Anyway, so both they could meet at Wembley, which would be an interesting little battle. So we'll round up those the loan action at the end of the season in loan reports. Moving on, Lucy Taylor. Will a poor season be good for the lifelong fans surrounded by those with unrealistic ambitions for the club? And also, she says, do we want new owners or like managers? Do they need longer? Will they be inspired by Leicester? First part of the question. Do you think the fan base at large will be more patient, having had to sit through a couple of years of misery?
They'll become more ambivalent. I think, and the problem is as well is that a lot of the fan base has decided they don't like McDermott, so unless he produces a playoff run, they're not going to become more patient. They're just going to keep saying the same thing, we're going down next season, even if we aren't in this season coming up.
Certainly the new breed of fan is going to is going to increase the negativity factor, and it's going to grate on those who have more of a lifelong background to them. I think with lifelong supporters is they tend to understand that the longer you go on supporting a club like Reading, you tend to understand that seasons like this happen, and football goes around in cycles, and we're in a particularly low ebb at the moment in the grand scheme of things. But ultimately, one day, it's gonna improve.
And it makes it worthwhile. You appreciate the good times so much more because you've sat through the bad times. But at the same point, if you offer me the chance of, do you want 10 bad years followed by 10 good years, or just 20 good years? Obviously, going to take 20 good years. It's not.
Of course, we will.
There's not a question.
Yeah,
about that.
And also the problem, the Leicester question, relating that to the fans, is that while it can inspire the owners or the management who are relatively new to football, etc., it will whatever the opposite of inspire is, de-inspire.
Demotivate
the fans, who will be fans of envy and will be jealous of that and think, why can't we get that? They've done things a certain way, we've not done things that way, therefore we should have, etc.
And that boils down to the whole club at the top end pulling in the right direction and having a clear and defined strategy, I suppose.
It does.
And there isn't at the moment.
It's a question that's very hard to answer beyond anecdotal evidence, but we've obviously seen a fairly significant drop-off in the fan base over the last two or three seasons. If you looked at the sort of crowds, we were getting 12,000, 13,000 crowds again, and that's including season ticket sales, which were, 11,500, 12,000 at the start of the season? Who do you think is deserting the club at the moment, Dave? Do you think it's the older fans that have become jaded with the whole football experience, or is it the younger fans that are fed up because Reading aren't winning again? I know it's very tricky, but just from sort of your rough experiences as a long-suffering Reading fan.
I think the older fan tends to generally be a season ticket holder, and I do know a number of long-standing supporters who haven't just given up their season ticket, but are completely given up attending matches these days. I don't know too many younger fans to be able to comment. But having said that, 10 years ago, you had your 15, 16-year-old, 17, 18-year-old who started going on the back of Reading's success. I don't see too many 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds going now. And certainly those supporters that started going at the back end of that success, having known only success since then up until sort of 2012, they've given it 3 or 4 years, some of them even less than that, and now they're not going. I think that's what it is. I think it's the people that started going sort of 3, 4, 5, 6 are now deserting the club now that we're not winning more than we're losing.
Mark, you're a younger fan.
You've got to look at the sorry to...
It's all right, no, go.
Interrupt. You've got to look at the attendance figures, just pure and simple, the attendance figures from 2002-03, we averaged 14,000, 3-4, 15,000, 4-5, 16,000, 5-6, second half of that season, bang, you know, away season tickets, half season tickets. We were getting 22s and 23s, and the only reason why we weren't selling out the full 24,000 was because of the away attendance figures.
Yeah.
Those crowds started to depreciate in 2007-08. The crowds at in the second Premier League season, there were small pockets of empty seats in the top ends of the far extremities of the upper west, and then 8-9 you were ending up with 18s and 19s, 9-10, 15s and 16s and 17s in the second half of the season, 10-11, 15s and 16s again, 11-12, similar, 12-13, back up to a 7-8 period, 13-14 was down to about 17s and 16s again, and it's just slowly started to appreciate.
What do you reckon there, Mark, from a younger fan's point of view?
Yeah, I kind of think that you've sort of named me in that sense, is that I've started coming in 03-04 a couple of games, then I got half season ticket.
Bandwagon jumper,
in
plastic.
05-06.
Shouldn't have let you on this podcast.
And I haven't been going to many games this year.
Plastic.
Partly because I'm often not in the continent, partly because I'm also working weekends now, but also because I think we're still pulling the families. I think the family thing for the club is good and it's important, it's necessary, and that's still happening. I think there's a lot of fans who, like you say, we had the, when we go down, we don't necessarily lose all the fans. We lose the day trippers, but a lot of fans will stick around for a promotion push. They're happy to do that. But then when you fail a promotion push and you drop back down the league and then you stay down the league, you lose people, not entirely, but they'll think, instead of getting a season ticket, I'll go 3 games out of 4, or I won't go Tuesday nights, or I won't go every third Saturday. And that becomes more frequent that they don't go when we do even worse and there's absolutely nothing to play for. So I think it's sort of a mix of younger fans and older fans that feel that way. You can get them back very easily. You have a good run, they're back. You get 20,000. Yeah. If we
look
win
at the crowd
the
that we were getting
next
look,
season.
Look at that Middlesbrough crowd. Look at that Middlesbrough crowd earlier in the season when we beat them 2-0. We were playing well, we were winning games. 21,000.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then if you do that 4 games in a row, then you can get that.
I suppose that's what they've tried to do with the new age category that they have retained for next season. They're just trying to keep those age group interested even when it's naff, because they think, oh, well, it's only costing me £130?
Yeah, they're tapping into basically a market that's becoming more prevalent now. People who think, I'll have a season ticket, but I can afford to skip 3 or 4 games now. And that people with season tickets don't have to go to every game, but they won't now because they can afford not to. And yeah, it's sort of kind of the way things go. At least the clubs acknowledge that.
Well, again, it's a topic that we could probably devote an entire pub chat to. So I'll have to cut it short there because I'm aware that people are probably falling asleep by now. Well, they're not. We've got some high quality content. You listen to more. We'll give you more. Alex Butler. The Hal Robson Canoe Award for Underachievement will need renaming now. The Vidra Award? ?
I'm content to keep it the Hal Robson Canoe
Until Hal Robson Canoe
Until someone can go like 4 seasons underachieving or 5 or 6, then yeah, I'm happy with it being Robson Canoe.
I think you have to reward achievement, don't you? And Hal Robson Canoe has achieved something by being the perennial underachiever.
He won it back to back years. Jordan Obita, the current holder of the Hal Robson Canoe Underachiever Award. Remains to be seen who wins it next year. Matty Vidra, absolutely underachieved. Is he the biggest underachiever that Reading, in terms of overall expectations against performance, or does that still go to someone like a Royston Drenthe or an Emile Saifay?
Greg Halford, even. These sort of players who.
Halford hadn't really done it.
anywhere else. I think as soon as you arrive on big fees, then you are the held up.
I think when you match the club's record transfer fee for a permanent signing as a loanee, then you carry a burden of expectation. And there's no question that a player that scored the best part of 40 goals in two seasons of the Championship to only score three goals in the league, underachieved. Yeah. There's nobody else that's underachieved to that level.
He was the most expensive Reading signing ever because we paid more for his wages than we did for Mercer Fayes or for Greg Halfords. And when he's your biggest outlay on a player, then...
I still think that the player is... and the people might find this laughable for his achievements in a Reading shirt, but he's a quality player.
Oh, no, I agree. Absolutely agree. I would probably label Royston
Drenthe... He will score 20 goals next season if he's fit.
I would label Royston Drenthe more of an underachiever because he arguably had a higher ceiling. You don't get signed for Real Madrid for over £10 million but without having a tremendous amount of ability.
No, he didn't start well.
I entirely agree. In fact, I still maintain this, and I'm not seeing any player to even come close. That in terms of raw talent and ability, he's the best player that we've ever had. But in terms of application, he's the worst player we've ever had.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Brian Davis points out that Oxford's promotion means that we could see the Thames Valley Triangle rivalry reformed the season after next. I don't know whether he's tipping Oxford for back-to-back promotions or for Reading for relegation. Did Swindon go down in the end?
No, they stayed up. Yeah. They stayed up.
Well, Oxford Swindon, that would be a tasty one on the
Didcot Triangle back, is what I'd call it, is you'd need us to go down.
Yeah, I feel slightly dirty wishing for Oxford or Swindon to get promoted.
Swindon almost did go up with Charlie Austin a few years ago. But
and last season, they lost. Final last year, they lost?
4-0 against Preston.
Yeah, that was absolutely humped, didn't they?
Yep.
Oh dear, what a shame. Matt Castle, who's been a regular contributor to the show this year. Thanks, Matt. He says, do we know if anyone has taken the role of assistant manager? As far as I know, it's just McDermott and a collective of coaches at the moment. Have any of those coaches stepped up to the role, or is that something we'll be addressing before next season? Chris Davis. He was appointed as first team coach. Now, I don't know whether that means he's the most senior or not, because they've obviously got Stephen Reid and Dave Besant, who's the goalkeeping coach as well. And it does seem to be a bit of a collective, because I haven't seen much of Chris Davis.
Because originally it was supposed to be Terry Burton, wasn't it? He lasted all of, 2 weeks?
Yeah, he decided to do
he was on the Frank Lampard senior role.
He was the assistant.
It has to be said, I'm not a bench watcher, so I don't know. But has Chris Davis been particularly vocal or prevalent on the sidelines?
I see Stephen Reid more than I see Chris Davis, but then again, I'm not massively familiar with what Chris Davis looks like. Johnny would be a good one to ask, because Johnny sits in the West End, but, as usual,
I think
Johnny's not here.
Just going off on a tangent, I think the assistant manager question is it's extremely important to ask. Because, essentially, and if we're looking at... different managers do things in different ways, and it's explained extremely well in John Keane's book, Some of the Parts, and the fundamental differences between the likes of Tommy Burns, Alan Pardew, Steve Coppell. Steve Coppell was quite happy for Kevin Dillon and Wally Downs to go off and do the midfield attack and defence respectively, and obviously Sal doing the goalkeepers. But the assistant manager, and the experience that I've had of really paying attention to football styles of play, they have a dynamic bearing on the style of play. Now, the case in point that I can allude to is Martin Allen and Kevin Dillon. Now, Martin Allen was the sacrificial lamb to Alan Pardew when we weren't doing particularly well, sort of knocking mid-table 2001, ended up getting promoted. We were a very direct side when Alan Pardew had Martin Allen as his number two. Alan was let go. Kevin Dillon introduced.
Martin was let go, rather.
Martin Allen. Kevin Dillon was introduced, and the style of play changed. The style of play changed quite dramatically. We weren't as direct. We were much more football based, I suppose you could say.
Considered.
Yeah, in our approach, and I have no qualms in saying that I think a lot of the signing of John Solarco, and more importantly Kevin Watson, was Kevin Dillon, because Kevin Dillon wanted a ball player in that midfield, or suggested a ball player in that midfield, whereas before we had Phil Parkinson and Keith Jones and Neil Smith. Ball winners, but not ball players. 100% wholehearted, but yeah. Dillon introduced something different. And again, you take a look at McDermott and his time in charge at Reading and at Leeds, he had Nigel Gibbs as his number two. Now, all the time that Nigel Gibbs has been McDermott's number two, the style of play has progressed generally to very direct. Now, when they were in charge of Leeds, they signed Matt Smith in the pre-season. What are you going to do when you sign Matt Smith? 6 foot 6 inch striker, launch it up front.
Memorable debut at Reading as well.
For Fulham, yeah, absolutely.
Fulham, yeah.
And exactly the same, a similar sort of style of play, different variants. In the first 6 months, it was all centred around Sigurdsson. You couldn't play a direct game around Sigurdsson. But once Sigurdsson had gone, we ended up focusing everything around Shane Long and introducing Mikael Leisurewood to sit back and allow more of the midfield to get forward. No surprise that in the second half of that season, we started doing well after we signed Leisurewood, and Leisurewood had got up to speed. We were playing a lot of channel balls. And that's not long ball, but it's direct football.
Yeah.
The channel balls for Shane Long.
And Noel Hunt as well.
And Noel Hunt as well, yeah, absolutely. And then, again, once we lost Shane Long, first half of the next season, we had Lafonda and Church up front. Now, again, you're not going to be getting particularly consistent results with those two up front when you're playing direct football. Jason Roberts. It wasn't channel balls. It was balls into his chest and playing off Jason Roberts and his brute strength. So, with Nigel Gibbs there, it was very direct in different manners. They found the way of playing. Now, he doesn't have Nigel Gibbs as his number two. He doesn't have any number two. We're not seeing a particularly direct style of play. We're seeing a much more, and similar to sort of Kevin Dillon, Martin Allen, Kevin Dillon analogy I gave earlier, we're seeing a much more considered approach. It isn't necessarily successful. Centred around different formations to try and get the best out of the squad so far. So I think what I suppose I'm deducing from this is that in order to absolutely highlight and nail down, pin down a particular style of play and an emphasis on a particular area of strength, is for him to sign a good tactical number two.
Mm. I always wonder why he hasn't done that so far. Davis, his background was in tactical analysis and technical review. He worked with Brendan Rodgers at Swansea and Liverpool. He was widely praised for the work he did, sort of analysing things down. So it will be interesting to see how he does.
Set piece expert as well, wasn't he?
Yeah,
by all accounts.
Sadly, but we haven't got one on the pitch.
Yeah,
so.
I think he recognised that. I don't think that's a great secret that he'd like to sign somebody. You know, he had Gylfi Sigurdsson, and replaced him with Ian Hart.
A final point on style of play is we're effectively still playing the same style of play we were under Clark, and that's the way we fit, way that both Clark and McDermott feel they can get the best out of the players with this squad, because there's probably going to be such a turnover in the summer. We could see a completely different style of play.
Yeah, absolutely. It remains to be seen. Absolutely. Anyway, that rounds up the mailbag. A massive thank you to everybody who has got in touch with us this season via @thetylersend on Twitter, thetylersend@gmail.com, and who has given our Facebook page a like at facebook.com/thetylersend. Please feel free to keep your emails coming in. We will be doing a mid-summer show at some stage.
Summer's ended, hasn't it? We've had our 3 days of sun.
We have, yeah. You are correct. We'll be doing a early winter show. Probably some point late June, early July, and then before the full season preview show.
Should we do it a pre-season friendly?
It has been mooted before. I think technologically it may prove challenging, given I don't know how we can record so well at Boreham Wood.
We could probably get a press pass for Didcot.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, that big press area.
Leave that with us. It is a good idea that we will consider. But anyway, keep your thoughts coming in using that #TTPodcast and the email account. We will keep them and read them out in the next show. So thank you very much to everyone who has contributed this season. And also big, big thank you to those of you who contributed to the crowdfunding campaign. It's still open if you do want to. You have got a couple of quid spare at the end of the month and you want to chuck it in into the Tylerstone coffers. Very much appreciated. It has helped fund numerous audio improvements. You're probably not hearing the best of it today, as we're back to our old school style of a single mic in a pub.
But generally, hopefully, you've noticed an improvement. And to those of you who have given up your hard-earned cash to help us, it does mean a lot. We do this generally pretty much for free, so your money goes directly towards helping fund improvements. And hopefully, so you've noticed that. So a big thank you. But even if you haven't managed to put up your own cash, even just by sending us a tweet, reading the site, bookmarking us, mentioning us to a mate, it was all very much appreciated. So we passed 5 years earlier, and I like to think we're bigger than ever. And that the little trickles of money and the feedback and everything just helps nudge us along, because we're our volunteers at the end of the day, and it's those little messages of support or physical means of support that keep you going when you're a bit bored and you're having to write on a turgid defeat at home again. So again, a massive thank you. We are got a little bit left in the tank though before we wrap up the show, so let's move on to any other business.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Any other business?
Final segment of the final show of the season. If you've made it this far, you are our listener of the season. There is no reward for that, but you know, a hearty thank you to you.
Folks. Acknowledgement.
Indeed.
Reward enough.
Indeed. We've given you an absolute bumper show to make up for the fact that there won't be many episodes of this podcast over the summer. There might be a podcast extra this week. I'm going to catch up with Charles to get his closing thoughts on the season. But otherwise, as mentioned, this is just done.
He needs his trophy, doesn't he, as well?
No.
Or does he not?
No, and that is that leads us on very nicely. Charles, much like his beloved Arsenal, blew a perfect chance to win the Prediction League. The man that won it is not here today. Johnny Williams took the crown by a single point from Charles. Johnny finishing with 32 points, Charles on 31. I finished third on 24, so couldn't defend my title. Westy on 20, and you've missed out by a single point. But bearing in mind, you only joined about a third of the way through the season. You probably would have been on pace for third place. So
yeah, I'll re-enter next season and go for the whole. I still think you should give me those Bristol City points.
I'm still not giving you those Bristol City points.
Hard man.
In fact, you can have them now if you want, because it doesn't make any difference. So yeah, you can get 22 points if you want.
Yeah, there we go. Lovely stuff. Yeah, excellent. Fine. Yeah,
cool.
I'll have them.
Cool. Okay. Well, with the revised point standing, you're still fifth. Sorry.
I can't be.
On average point. On average
fourth.
Yeah, you are. Oh, yeah, you would be. Yeah, okay. Okay, I'll promote you. There you go. You finished above Westy.
Well, lovely. Yep.
Only because Westy isn't here to defend himself. I will mention on Westy as well, he was due to join us today, but the extended celebrations from his wedding over the weekend. Many congratulations to Westy. It means he couldn't be. He's still got family down.
What was my invite?
I don't know.
Did you get one?
I was invited along to the evening. Wow. You know, you're hurt.
I'm hurt.
I couldn't go because I was working, unfortunately. And he missed mine.
You could have passed it on.
And he missed mine because he was watching some pokey team at Wembley in an FA Cup semi final.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, you know.
Chestnut.
Yeah, that old
Arsenal.
Chestnut. Yeah, he's watching Arsenal. So many congratulations to Westy. Will announce as well. He was going to announce it himself. But Westy is taking virtual retirement from this show. He's the man that has taken part in Reading Podcast ever since, you know, he started the Football Fancast back in 2009, I think it was. It might have even been 2008. I think it was after we lost at home to Southampton. So when was that? Was that 2008 or 2009?
Would that have been the 2-1 defeat with Bradley Wright Phillips scoring twice and Jimmy Kebbe scoring his first goal for
it
Reading?
It was.
That was one of the only games I've left early.
Was that late 2008?
That was November 2008.
Yeah. So
we were unbeaten at home up until that point, and we were expected to absolutely annihilate them. To annihilate them, and they turned up and did a number over us.
For 7.5 years, Westy has given up a night a week regularly. Obviously, he started the show. He was the one to edit it and put things together. It continued. After the Fancast ended, he joined up with Johnny Fordham and Alan Williams as well, his co-host. They took on the Royals Post podcast and put that out for, I think they clocked up close to 100 episodes as well before Johnny left. And then we took up the mantle, said 93 episodes ago. Westy on board from the beginning. But I said he's got mentioned. He's got, I think his family's now swollen to 6 kids in all. And with work commitments as well, he just can't commit the regular time. So he's promised he's not gone away for good. He is still promised to make the odd guest appearance, as we've seen from people like my dad and Rob Langham. But unfortunately, he's semi-retired now. So I can only thank Westy for everything he's given to the show. I'd give him a testimonial, but...
I didn't quite reach 100.
He did quite. Yeah, didn't reach 100 episodes of this podcast, so he doesn't get one. Yeah, didn't reach 10
years. Next time.
Yeah, didn't reach 10 years of podcasting. So, but no, thank you very much to Wesley. I said he's not gone away for good. He has promised to pop up now and again to bail us out if we're short on members. But I wanted to, the person at the time, I said as a co-founder of this show, thought it was only right that he gets his due. So, thank you very much to Wesley. Yeah, there we go. Warm round of applause. Well done. Sign of his dedication. He wasn't even here to turn up to get a free pint. So that shows how he really does. You really did have other commitments tonight. So thank you to Westy, and obviously thank you to everyone else who has appeared on this show as well. Johnny and Rob and my dad, Steve. We've had, who else?
John Keane.
John Keane has appeared, yeah, as well. And I think there's someone else I might be missing, but apologies. Our Sims turned up, I think, as well. And everybody who turned up for the Christmas show as well. But anyway, we have still, that isn't the end of the show. We have got a couple of things to discuss. Just very quickly, we touched on next season's championship. Just thought I'd give you the early bookies odds that were done before tonight's playoff semi-final. The bookmakers are running 7-1 to win promotion and 10-1 to go down. If you had £1, where's that pound going?
Take the value bet.
It's a relegation.
Down. At this moment in time, we're more likely to go down than up.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't even lay it at the moment, simply because you don't know what's going
to
happen.
What's fascinating to me is, and this is only through Skybet, but Reading, I think, admittedly, there's only 20 teams to choose from because there's still four places to be decided, but there were only, I think, five teams rated less likely than Reading to get relegated. Despite the fact that they are not fancied to go up, I think, again, there's only about five teams below Reading that are, in terms of promotion odds, we're not rated very highly to go down, and for me that means there's value in that bet, because I think Blackburn are like 7-1 to go down. I think Cardiff, Wolves are fourth favourite at the moment to get relegated.
We're just right in amongst that mid table. Like, we probably have about 10-15 teams on the same odds as us.
No, we don't. And this is what I'm saying, Reading are a little class above in terms of the bookies. Just seems to think we're safe.
I'll take that. That's all I can say. I'll take that.
Yeah.
Bookie's ready to get it wrong.
Yeah. Any games in
particular? Hello,
Leicester. Any games in particular you're looking forward to next season? We mentioned Newcastle, Villa, and Norwich coming down.
I quite like a trip to Norwich, mainly because my brother lives up that way. But also, I absolutely love the city. They're money-grabbing shysters, but I think that's...
come on! You've now...
35 quid for a championship match.
Yeah.
Money-grabbing shysters.
For emphasis. Wigan away.
Yeah.
Always a good one. Last time I got there 8 minutes late on the start of the season before the one we're talking about because of traffic issues. But when you're not late, there's a pub in the away end.
Yeah, just outside the away end, isn't there? Yeah.
I still think this, nice. The DW Stadium is a bit of a soulless experience.
I think so, yeah.
As you said, I've got family ties to Wigan.
The Will Greggs on Fire song will certainly, if that manages to persist until... I have enjoyed that one.
Yeah, until the next one.
Yeah, I can't wait for it to be cannibalised by every club.
Everyone, yeah. Of course, it inevitably will be. Newcastle, Villa, Norwich, as I say, I quite enjoy a trip to Norwich and Ipswich as well.
Burton as well, smaller stadium.
Yeah. I'd like to, I probably won't get a chance, but I'd like to go to Newcastle. I've been twice now for Reading, and for once I'd like us not to lose 3-0. Both the times I've went, we lost 3-0. So
I've yet to make the pilgrimage up there, so I would like very much.
Genuinely think it's one of the best away grounds in the country, if not the best. So
the other teams in playoff contention, it's looking like Millwall, Barnsley. No real love for either Oakwell or the New Den, to be honest.
Personally, and this is a bit of a laugh here, but I'd much prefer Walsall to go up. A, because I put a little double on Sheffield Wednesday and Walsall to go up before the playoff started. But B, because I haven't actually done Walsall before. Probably as plastic as you like, given the number of times we've played them over the last 15 years. But no, I've never actually done Walsall.
Driven past it countless times, because it's right on the motorway, so it'd be easy to get to. I'd like to think we'd take some people.
So it's interesting. And again, this is absolute pie in the sky, but if you had to put, you had a pound to put, a £3 to put on where Reading are going to finish next season, where is your pound going?
I always say 12th for these, because it's, I mean, you probably get the worst odds for 12th, but in terms of realistically, are we going to get a bit better? We have to get a bit better. Are we going to get any worse? I hope not. So yeah, 12th.
Dave?
18th.
18th. I'm gonna go bold, and I'm actually going to say Reading are going to make a surprise playoff push next season. 6th. But this is coming.
I would welcome that. Naturally.
This is coming from the man that, after the Middlesbrough game, did lump a substantial amount of money on Reading to win the league. So
I think if we make a playoff push, it'll be late in the season. It'll be too late, and we'll finish about ninth.
He does need a transition period, as Brian.
It needs to be given time and patience. It's what he needs.
It is one of the most fascinating seasons I think we're heading into, because it's going to tell us so much about the ownership of the club, about Brian's real managerial ability and his use of the transfer market. We're just going to learn. It's been so by the numbers for the last 6 months. There's not really been a lot to get our teeth into. But that's all going to change over the next two or three months. Could be amongst the most pivotal we've seen in Reading Football Club's history. It will tell us so much, and I'm nervous and excited in equal measure.
I also kind of fear that you can change everything. You can change all the players. You can change the setup of the team. You'll probably have McDermott in charge, and we could still do exactly the same as we've done for the last two seasons and have a bit of a cup run, finish 17th. Go nowhere. It's probably the most likely thing to happen.
The beauty of football, as Dave pointed out earlier, Brighton finished, was it one place below us or above us last season?
Below us last season,
yeah, and finished third.
Never ever rule out any championship club from putting a push together.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of the division, is that before the start of this season, probably 22 of the 24 clubs had realistic ambitions of finishing in the top six.
Yeah,
you know, that's literally it. And the season before that, there was probably only one or two clubs, again, Blackpool being one, but that had no realistic ambition of finishing anywhere other than sort of outside relegation. There are so many clubs that are, you know, that are of a muchness in terms of ability. It's so close to the division that it's sort of paper thin between, you know, every club pretty much. And it's borne out again this season with us. You look at the games that we've played, and we've not been, or shall we say, rarely been
outclassed.
Yeah, we've had some sound beatings, but we've not been outclassed generally over the course of the season. We're not that far away. Just needed to score a few more goals.
Needed a bit more clinical at the front end, and it needed a few less errors at the back end. You know, you look back at the games where Al Habsi and, you know, Bond at Sheffield Wednesday, Al Habsi said against QPR, and
you need a professional winning mentality to grind out those results when
Vidra
you're not
puts
well.
Away, Vidra puts away that chance at Middlesbrough. I've just reeled off 8 points. That's 5-6 points Reading could have had,
and
right there.
That's nine places in the way we've been this season.
MK Dons, Vidra misses a chance. Yes. Those home games against Leeds and MK Dons, it's the same fine ones, but that's why we love the Championship. That's why it is great. And as much as I've loved Leicester's rise up, I still think the Premier League is far more formulaic, and the Championship has got that greatness about it. Congratulations to you, Leicester, by the way. I should give our resident Leicester listener, one Ian Wilson, one of my ushers at my wedding, he emailed in constantly to this show in the past couple of years, and now is enjoying the fruits of
it. I think it's a wonderful story, isn't it? It's brilliant for football that we've had another name now at the top table, dining off that centrepiece, that throne.
Yeah,
at the top end of the room,
and to have done it without spending hundreds of millions. I mean, they've spent, but they've not spent. There are a lot more than they spent less than people like Newcastle and Villa.
Yep, and there are a lot of parallels with their success. Obviously, it's a far greater achievement simply because of the teams that they've usurped. But there are a lot of parallels with their achievement and our achievement in 2006. And it's the first time they've ever won that division. At the start of the season, it was a team of no real stars. It was a everybody at that club pulling in the right direction, in the same direction, with a tactically astute manager who settled on a system and a formation, played very few players, very few changes, only when he really had to. Didn't really change the winning side. They ended up only losing three games all season, which is in itself
ridiculous.
Remarkable in itself.
Yeah.
The 2005-06 side, the parallels with that, which is what just brought it all home a little bit more for me, I suppose. And not only that, is a lot of it for me also was the way that Leicester treated us when we went up.
Yeah,
back in that season,
very very classy.
I was really hoping from the outset, when it became clear that they were genuine title contenders, I was just genuinely hoping that they were going to do it.
It's good for the vitality of the English game in general. It goes down to us as Reading fans as well. So in Germany, Bayern have won the last four Yeah, Bundesliga's, they'll win the next seven probably. Juventus have won the last five of Serie A's, they'll win next year's.
PSG dominating.
PSG are going to dominate France for the next 5-10 years.
PSG have got 91 points, 92 points, with a 70 or something goal difference.
Yeah, they're miles clear. And
that's not healthy for the French league.
No.
In England now, we've had three different winners in the last 3 years, which it's important to have that. And Spain as well. Is a triopoly now.
Yeah, four in the last 4 years, isn't it? United, City, Chelsea, and Leicester.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it just rekindles that little bit of hope. Little tiny shred of hope in the back of your mind that one day Reading could do better than that eighth place finish. Because that has been one of my little nagging feelings at the back of my head this season as I've grown older and enter my 22nd year as a Reading fan next season. Is it ever going to be any better? And I think you need something to dream for as a football fan, because if you've been there and you've done it and you've seen it, it's easy to be jaded. And I can understand some fans that maybe think that it's never going to get any better for Reading. But you need that little thing to hold on to, whether it's I want to see Reading do it with a core of academy players, or I want to see Reading do it with a load of flair of, you know, foreign players, or
then also being
obviously Reading win 4-3 at Blackburn on the last day of the season.
Also, being at the level we're at now, you've got to be careful what you wish for, because there are a lot of teams that thought, oh yeah, mid-table championship, mid-table Premier League, boring, are now in League Two or Conference, or don't exist as a football club anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, it happens. It can get worse. Trust me.
Indeed. So with the positive, you know, as I said, Reading are in the championship again. We're guaranteed of what probably are amongst our top 20 league finishes, no matter where we finish next season. We've got a man who's very passionate about the football club leading it. I know you're not all McDermott fans out there, but there has been zero evidence to me to ever suggest that he doesn't all but bleed blue and white Brian McDermott. He really does genuinely care, and finding a manager like that is a dime a dozen. And I'm just hoping that Reading don't turn into a Watford who have now ditched a promotion winning manager followed by a survival winning manager, and we don't enter into that sort of mentality. But I said I was going to end on positive notes, so I will. And the positives are that, as we said, anything can happen. We've got a good little group coming through, the likes of Fosu and Samuel, and Cooper's going to have another year under his belt and hopefully be better. Jordan Obita can't be any worse than he was last season. A lot of players have only got room to go up. So fingers crossed it all comes together. We will be here for the ride. We will be on thetunnelestend.com throughout the summer. And needless to say, thank you for all of your support, as mentioned. It is very much appreciated, and as I said, continue to interact. As I said, visit the website regularly. The podcast is taking a hiatus, but we're not on the web front. We are doing lots of post-season analysis at the moment, and there'll be lots of look ahead to the new campaign as well, so head over to tunnelestend.com for that. As mentioned, I will hopefully be back with Charles at some stage this week or next to do an end of season podcast extra, and we will return around the end of June, start of July, to do a little mid-season update. Might come a little bit earlier if there's big news, like if there's a takeover or McDermott does get sacked or something big happens, we will be back. But otherwise, look out for us around end of June, start of July, and then we'll be back in a regular rotation. Come on, but gentlemen, it has been a mammoth session. Oh, Dave's got one final point to make.
More point to make before we go. Monday, 23rd, is the final focus group meeting at Reading Football Club. Please get your ideas, your thoughts, your feelings in, and I will certainly congregate all those thoughts and ideas together.
You've had a lot in already, haven't you?
I have had a fair amount. Some fairly interesting ideas, it's got to be said. Some good feedback, both to the positive and to the negative. I'll feed everything back. They're not going to sanitise anything. But by all means, email in at thetarlestend@gmail.com,
yep.
Or by all means, tweet me direct, or tweet the Tarlest End.
Hashtag TTE focus group.
It's hashtag TTE focus group. However you so feel to
carrier pigeon, smoke signals.
Yeah, exactly.
Telegram.
I'll answer to anything. But yeah, absolutely. There's been
pager.
There's been a good response initially from the meeting back in January. I will compile all the outcomes from it and submit another article up on the Tarlest End. Look out for that. later on next week. If you have any thoughts and feelings, then get them to us, and I will certainly relay them to the club.
Absolutely. And on that note as well, thank you very much to Star as well. They've given us a little helping hand over the last few months as well. And so we'll hopefully be working a bit closer with them next season as well to get a bit more news and info from their side out. So stay tuned for that. But that is it. That is a mammoth show in the books. We started recording this at 7:30. It is now 10:15. Did Derby do it, Dave?
No.
They didn't do it. So
£26 million worth of talent in the Championship next season. I wonder how much they're going to spend this pre-season.
I would like to get home and find that Nick Blackman missed a chance in the last minute.
Please. It is the moral of the story. For all we've discussed tonight is that some things never change.
Indeed. On that note, we are out of here. Thank you very much. And as some things never change, I will end, as we always do. Come on, you arse.